I'm Dustin Zahn, and this is Trainwrecks. On today's episode, we have Hiroko Yamamura, a.k.a. Yomama Mura, the self-professed meme queen and techno machine. She was also one-third of the Twitch show called Misery Index with drum cell and Luis Flores. When she's not globetrotting all over playing techno and house music for people, she's playing video games, watching anime, and making tracks with some really exciting names and dance music. So check all of that out if you're interested. Funny thing about her is, I don't remember the last time or the first time that I met her, but I want to say it was like within the last handful of years, maybe post-pandemic. I'm not sure. I could be wrong on that. Anyway, you know, I would talk to all these guys in the States and, well, girls too, but mainly guys. And they'd be like, yo, man, you got to meet Hiroko. She's a trip. And I kept hearing that, but I kept missing her or seeing her in passing. And eventually I got to know her, and she is indeed a trip. Really nice person, super funny, you know, pretty raw. She can hang with just about anybody, you know, go hard, all that kind of stuff. And so that means she's good people. It's also kind of interesting, you know, I caught her when she was here in Berlin. And I want to say like the last three or four times I've played in Berlin, we've actually been on the same lineup, which is kind of bizarre, but I'll take it. That means I always get to hang out with her, and I'm looking forward to that just as much. For those of you who are hoping that it'll kind of go off the rails and I'll get myself canceled, we were kind of hoping for that, but at the same time, I had a pretty massive hangover when we recorded this, so it doesn't get that wild, but it's still a good listen. I hope you enjoyed the episode, but first, we got a couple things we got to talk about. I think you know what they are. First things first, July 26th to July 28th, it's the Great Beyond. If you've been a listener of the podcast, you know what's up. If you don't, it's basically this techno camp out I've been putting together with my friends in Telefunk for, I think this is the fourth or fifth year now. We pretty much just bring a bunch of speakers out into the middle of nowhere and go crazy for 3 days. We try to pick the coolest psychedelic and whatever kind of vibey music that you can find from techno and house and just blast it for 3 days straight. We got all kinds of crazy names. Just to mention some, we got Steve Rockmod, Rue, Rod Hod, Wada Igarashi, Polygonia, GGFM, Hyperactive, BMG, Daniel Bell, and more. So if you're looking for something to do this summer that doesn't quite break the wallet, check this party out. If you're going to Detroit, check it out on May 24th. We got Metatophysica. It's a party that we've been doing for 3 or 4 years as well. We're doing it alongside Blank Code. Lineup's pretty killer for that. You got Centrific, Corbin Davis, myself, Canding Ray, Kyle Geiger, Lauren Lychee, Marius of Skaya, Miles Surge, Orbe, Renee Wise, and Takaki Ito. There's actually a nice little handful of Detroit debuts in that, so come on down, check it out, and start your weekend with a face plant. If you're living in Minneapolis on May 11th, make it out to our Mind Control conference called Mind Control Made Easy. Ben Mann's your will through the use of the fourth dimension. Learn to channel, control, and master mind control. You'll be able to learn morally ambiguous techniques from real experienced psychic outsiders such as Ignez, Kriz, and Liv Wu-Tang. The Grand Overseers themselves, Centrific and myself, will be doing an opening ritual, so make sure you get there early. Just a few things you can learn that are coming in our 8-hour course. You can master mind control through fourth-dimensional thought based on the Baldarian principle of metaconsciousness projection as outlined by the Praetorian Council. You can harness the power of and become one with the void. If you don't like light workers, you can shatter light worker defense mechanisms and manipulate them to your will. We'll also be giving you tips on how to protect your neurotonic syntaxes from the Tarzishians, aka the reptilians, via ritual hold. If that sounds like a good time to you, follow us up at greatbeyond.us and buy some tickets. Last but not least, I got a new podcast out on Reclaim Your City. So if you're looking for a couple hours of vibey, trippy stuff to get down to, look no further. Head over to SoundCloud and Google that. Not much to say about it, but I hope you like it. All right, let's get into this episode, huh? You ready to do this?
Let's do it. What's up, Dustin Zahn?
How are you doing?
I am great. Really excited to visit, get to stare. I'm in the studio staring at Dustin eye-to-eye contact, so it's really intense.
Yeah. Intense, very awkward.
We had a good weekend.
Too long for me anyway.
Yes.
You played Monday morning. I played Sunday night. I was around for all of it. Too long.
It felt like it was nice to have everybody there, but it's so weird that like so many homies can be at the same club for the same event, but you don't actually run into each other.
I want to get to talking about you, introduce some new people to you here. Ooh. And we'll just start with the easy questions. Like, what was your first introduction to dance music?
So I came in through raves and dance culture, kind of through the industrial scene. So, you know, at that time, I definitely did not equate like even dancey synth pop to dance music. To me, it was still like new wave and kind of, I guess, scene music when you're young. And a lot of those definitions were from like older kids or my sisters telling me like, this is the genre. I guess in Chicago, we had juice bars. I don't think you guys had those in Minneapolis, did you?
It didn't really take off. I think there was a little bit, but...
So there are quite a few competing juice bars in high school. Like there was this place called Off the Alley and then this place called Jubilations, which was Harvey Expo Center later. But before that, it was a Photon like laser tag thing. And on the weekends, it was this juice bar that you could go to. So it was just kind of something to do and to stay out of trouble. And they play a lot of like, kind of corny dance music at the time, but they would always kind of mix in a little bit of industrial and kind of new wave stuff. So slowly started maybe kind of tolerating what I thought was like, I don't know. I guess in high school we would say these are like the breakers, right? And like, you know, there was always kind of some weird subculture divide. And people would hang out in different groups and dress differently because we were corny teenagers trying to be cool. But maybe the first time I started to really think about dance music as a separate thing was maybe when grunge really popped off and electronica kind of became its own thing. And there was this kind of rush to get away from alternative music at that point because it became so MTV and commercial, and I think that's when I recognized it. And then gosh, when was my first party? 94, 95 maybe is the first raves I went to. It's I have such a bad memory about that stuff.
And if you're doing it right, you shouldn't remember much of it.
Yeah, right.
You know? But like, did you ever go to like Medusa or anything like that at that time?
I was going to the Congress Medusas, so I'd missed the first one. So
okay.
They had like an early night. So if you're under 17, you could go before, I think, 11. But Congress was big enough that you could actually hide. And then there was one room that kind of played music videos, a little bit of alternative. The other side, they'd play dance music. And that definitely still was this part in time that was the other culture. Like going into the house music room was still like not cool to me. I was like, oh, this is not where the goth chicks are at, right? So but slowly you would kind of have this intertwining of those rooms, right? So I forgot what night it was, but they're playing like the Out Here Brothers, right? And people are like dancing, and suddenly the DJ drops Thieves and everyone just starts fighting in the middle of the club. And I was like, this is great. I love this crossover. So,
right on. And then like, how did it eventually land up where like you you were like, I think I'm just going to focus on playing house and techno or whatever.
So I started off listening mostly to like hardcore, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of like industrial strength, Rotterdam stuff, just because it seemed like edgy and extreme. And I think that's what's like going on in music right now. So, you know, people are kind of critical of the new hard techno that's going on. But it was kind of a similar journey for me. I was like, this stuff is so hardcore, and this drop-based stuff that was coming out and industrial strength stuff, like those were extremes. So I kind of leaned towards those.
But it was sincere also. And like the stuff these days, it doesn't feel as sincere.
I mean, some of that Mokum stuff was not sincere. Right?
Fair. Yeah. But yeah. I guess just the whole mentality, it was kind of like, almost more like punk rock or pit style stuff where it's like, fuck you.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Yeah, I'm playing this harder than you. And now it's like,
I think that's kind of similar though. Right.
Yeah?
It's just like, it's hard to tell because when you're younger, right, you're not really thinking that far ahead. You're just like, this doesn't sound like house. And you know, when you're from the Midwest, you hear Bad Boy Bill and Julian Jumpin' Perez on the radio. So it's kind of didn't feel special at that time, right? It felt like it was everyday music. You'd get to hear DJ Funk on the radio, cool stuff like that. You don't appreciate it until later. So, and then I shifted into playing drum and bass because it just seemed like the British thing to do, right? And I was like, this is what the cool Brit kids are doing, because shoegaze is not a thing anymore. So I guess we're in a drum and bass now.
But late 90s drum and bass was the shit.
Yeah,
there's plenty of drum and bass in all eras. It's good. But for me, I was super into it back then at that point.
Like the tech step and you know, those aesthetics, when drum and bass kind of moved away from this really kind of technical and dry sound, is maybe when I started becoming more interested in techno, because a lot
Same,
of those
yeah.
those kind of cleaner sounds and aggressive sounds were more represented there versus this like overly exaggerated aggressive sound, right? And you know, I think that's, there were just shifts in music that were happening at that time. And then of course Hyperactive and Mike Dearborn, became friends with them early, and they're really awesome about like sharing music. And at the time, you really had to ask the people what that track was, right? I had no idea even what the genre differences were, right? The techno or house, especially those guys, they blended it together.
Yeah,
so,
I couldn't tell. It's like, what do you call this? I don't know.
Yes.
I mean, the probably the easiest answer would be tech house, but nowadays you think of tech house as like this bastardized Ibiza thing, you know, which it's not, but
the names always change. And I think, you know, also, I don't know if you knew Phil Freart at all.
No.
It's a happy hardcore DJ, really good friends of mine, unfortunately passed away, but this guy would just play anything on 45. So he'd take like a pop record and then mix it with a happy hardcore record or just some like GABA record. And we'd go see him. And so that even more confused me on what the genres were. And so I kind of just never really cared about what the genre was until maybe people presented it as a challenge. Like, what is that, a train
fucking
sound?
Street sweepers going by.
Oh,
apologies. That'll be gone in a minute here.
So techno for us was always a little less defined. I think even more Minneapolis.
This fucking guy. Like, sorry.
I like it.
The street is quiet all the time,
I like
except
it.
For right now.
I like it. It gives us like this kind of working sound.
Yeah. I'm going to have a little sip of my drink first here.
But even like Woody, right?
Mm-hmm.
McBride was very much more like straight up techno and acid producer, right?
Yeah.
Whereas I think in Chicago, we had a lot of people just kind of doing whatever, right? And if it happened to cross over, it would end up on DJX. If not, it would end up on like dance mania, and it didn't really matter, and the producers at the time kind of didn't care. Is that picking it up too much?
It's picking up quite a lot.
Hey, we'll take a break.
All right, sorry about that, people.
We had some nice street sweeper, but now the streets are clean.
We got a clean-ish street.
So yeah, those definitions were a little less defined, and through like the course of like 2 degrees of separation, I ended up with Hyperactive's old hardcore records. Like at the time when he first started producing, he was doing a lot of like hardcore and stuff. I don't know if he had some like UC releases at the time in Chicago. Like even the hard house was very much in that lane as well. So there's a lot of good tracks there that they kind of don't fit the genre, but that's just kind of was the sound at the time. And I think also was what we thought was going on in Europe, right? So it's like this trend we think is going on. And, you know, at the time, like hardcore was even turning into like breaks and like,
yeah, it went breakcore overnight, it seems like, at some point.
Yeah.
Like maybe 2000, 2001 or something.
That's when I was out. Yeah. I was like, I don't understand. This has got too much, like, Autechre influence and, like, yeah, so going to parties, you know, soon after these juice bars closed down, there was kind of just no option if you were under 18, right? So... Mm-hmm. I think you and I were talking about this, but like the Riviera at the time used to have this party called the Rear. And so I think that was one of the few 17 or 18 year old clubs you could go to, that had a cabaret license and had house music. And at the time it was more about just going out, right? And not going to some college bar in Chicago. So, yeah, you know, Honey, Derek, Frankie, all of them used to play there. I had no idea at the time, right? I was just like, well, this is wild. And we can hang out here. And, you know, it's pretty straight edge at the time. So it's like, you also didn't like misbehave kind of out of fear of getting the place in trouble as well. And somewhat with raves, there was also that mentality. And I think one of the nice things about the Midwest is like we would travel to go to parties. Like if there was a big show in Minneapolis or Wisconsin or Indiana, 6-7 hour drive was nothing, right?
Oh, yeah, like, you couldn't wait. That was half the fun.
Yeah. Rich is like, now I'm like, man, I got to go half an hour for something. That's
across town to see a friend you haven't seen in 4 years.
Like, or something, you know? Forget it. I'll Zoom you or something. Right. And so there was kind of this ecosystem going on, that I think it's faded, but I think it's also being picked up, like, especially with your guys' parties, there's like this rekindling of it, right. With,
in Chicago, you mean?
With your camp out,
yeah.
I think there's specifically that there's an ethos there, right? That I think was somewhat championed by other promoters in the past, but I think their own vision and whatever got in the way of some of that, and maybe excluded people. And everyone has tried to bring that back, right? But in the end, I always say to this, like, in the Midwest, the people that are actually doing stuff, although you can say there's a million DJs, there really was not that many, right?
Yeah.
So if you even just say techno producers early 2000s or late 2000s, you can count them on your hands in the Midwest, right? That were actually... pursuing this and sincerely kind of doing this as a career.
I mean, you could even also make that argument today to some respects. I mean, there's definitely a lot more people who are trying or aspiring. But when you look at it as a promoter, for a club or festival or whatever, there's kind of a limited amount of options of people that are like genuinely crushing it right now that will also sell a few tickets. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and like sometimes those are those new kids, but when you take the Midwest folks that have kind of either a catalog of releases, some history of excellent sets and a history of selling tickets and have a sincerity towards kind of DJing versus kind of approaching it as a legacy thing. And maybe it's just a thing, you know, there's so many artists I know that they are, you know, I don't want to speak for them, but observing them DJ, they're kind of just doing it to do it at this point, right? Which is fine, right? Like, if you have nothing else to do, then if this is paying the bills, then do it, right? But, yeah, I can count the amount of, I'd say, techno and house producers from at least my perspective that I can see and I think are kind of still kind of pushing the envelope on things, right? But that being said, I'm old, so there's a lot of stuff is probably going under my radar and you're only able to see what you're maybe aligned with, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's like really, it's not that it was a wake-up call. A lot of it I was aware of, but like there's obviously the generational shift. Let's just say pre-COVID and after COVID of like how people react to things when going out to clubs. And it's like, I'm not even necessarily saying one generation is better or worse than the other. It's just clearly different. And sometimes you see this sort of line drawn in the sand. You're like, holy shit, this really is a wild change, you know?
But there's a lot of people that their first contact with dance music was the internet, right? Like, mm-hmm. They weren't of age to even go to undergrounds or whatever. It was looking at stuff online and like longing for it. And I'm totally repeating myself on this thing I just said, but during lockdown, I would watch like videos of people going to restaurants and like eating spaghetti or just something. And I'm like, dude, I cannot wait till I get to go back to a restaurant, sit down with my friends and eat some like amazing food. This is like all I want if this can happen again. And so I think for a lot of people, they were at this kind of transitional point. Maybe they weren't doing this stuff yet where they just saw this thing that it didn't exist to them. It was only videos on the internet, but it was something to be looking forward to and be excited about. So I don't so much criticize this kind of internet, TikTok, rave culture, because I think that's how they came into it. So it's like that is their lane. It's its own thing now. I might not be that familiar with it, but I get it, because when I was sitting at home watching like travel videos and food videos, I was like, dude, I'll do anything for this to come back, right? So,
absolutely. I mean, like, so, like, you would call yourself like an extroverted person then, or do you just miss the occasional social contact?
I'm a pretty introverted person. I would say the people that I'm friends with and know well, like, it's a very Midwest thing. The people that know each other, maybe they have not. You know, you and I have not been in each other's sphere for very long, but mm-hmm. very aware of you for a very long time. But there's this kind of familiarity, right? Just even just running to each other at gigs and just, you know, for 20 or 30 years, you even like give each other a nod. There's like a certain comfort that comes from that, right?
Yeah.
So some of these people I've been going to like even further with for 30 years. So even though I don't know you, there's a certain amount of like, yeah, we were there when...
So wait, you were going to further?
I was always going to further.
I was there. It's crazy. You always like hear these stories of like, oh, wait, you were there too? Or yeah, 98 or, you know, like crazy.
Yeah, I would always go see, God, what was his name? Mouse? Dan Dormouse, right? And the whole massive crew. And yeah, that, you know, the events that kind of crossed Midwest were few and far between, right? There was Sexer 616 movements, kind of few standout parties. You guys were doing some amazing stuff, you and Zach, and but yeah, I was absolutely a consumer at that time too, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, yo, you should book me. But, you know, they're like, you suck. You barely train wrecking drum bass tracks. But yeah, there is a familiarity you get that when you've been kind of slightly even just partying with people for 20, 30 years, yeah, you don't know them, but you know them better than this person you're just meeting at a club, at least, right? So
yeah, you like get the sense that you're all kind of, you've been through it, or at least like, you know, even though you haven't talked about it, like they've probably been through a lot of the same shit I have, or they've been around, they know what's up, you know?
Well, even just musically, like the lens is similar, right? Like mm-hmm. the Midwest rave experience, it's unlike other places. Like it was, like we had it good, right? Like there was a lot of stuff. When it went bad for sure. And there was definitely struggle, but musically, I think, as a raver, we got a lot of good stuff that, you know, you put that out now, like it'd be like a massive festival, right? That people would pay $300 for.
Yeah. You know,
so.
No, I totally get it. I mean, I was talking to someone this weekend about it, you know, like, it's great that everybody's connected on the internet and everything now, but like when social media was less of a thing, each sort of region, whether it was in Europe or country or city, sort of had its own sound or vibe, a group of producers or whatever. And in a way that kind of made it exciting because, excuse me, you can't really tell that so much now. Like you wouldn't be able to say like, oh, this is that Neapolitan techno or something like that.
It's a luxury that we always wished for, right? Yeah. Like to be able to get this, like we were fighting over white labels, right? They would get one.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was about who got there first. And if they even told you it was there, right? You had to kind of be friends with somebody to get the track. Or even the DJ had to tell you what it was for you to even know to ask for it. So I was dreaming of a time when this would become easily distributed and digital, and it wasn't this fight, and I had to carry dub plates around or all this vinyl that for me was quite a bit to carry around. But then, you know, the reality is it you lose that kind of excitement about it, right? And you know, especially in drum and bass, like it went to extremes where we were like fighting over getting dubs of stuff, right? So the culture was about having releases before everybody else and knowing somebody cool that would float you a copy of an unreleased VIP. You'd cut it to an acetate that weighed 2 pounds. And you could play it 10 times. But those were the bragging rights then, right?
Exactly. Right? That's, that would get you booked, you know?
Yes. But that also became kind of its own gross thing you started chasing after a little while. You're like, why am I doing this, dude? Like, cutting this dub is, as these places were closing, it's getting more and more expensive, right? Like you could get a lacquer for $35 in Chicago in like, a week turnaround time. They weren't great, but they were something. And then we had friends that were like ripping stuff from Radio One and then we're re-piecing it together in acid. And so like you had these unauthorized dubs of stuff, but like we're just boosting the gain on it so it's playable. And then you're like, well, you really shouldn't be playing this. That's the whole point of this, right? So you're just being a poser right now. And you're like, it takes a minute to realize you're just being weird, you know?
I totally get it. I mean, that was especially a thing during like the 2006 sort of minus Richie Hawtin era. Like there was a thing with a lot of these promos that are like, you can't put this in any mix, blah, 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 because people were just fucking bootlegging this shit right out of DJ mixes and playing it in their sets, or like it would get released before it was ever out, you know? And it was always, you could always, if you paid attention, you could hear where it was chopped poorly and re-looped, like you said, in these programs. And I'm just kind of glad now that nobody, well, everybody wants the shit that nobody has, but I think everybody's too lazy to actually boost shit from things, or they know they'll get called out.
Yeah, but it was like, that's kind of how I first started learning how to produce, was just taking stuff and chopping it in like Sony Acid. And so that's part of exploring the ethos of electronic music, right? You're straight up stealing for sure, right?
No.
And when I was on Soulseek looking for tracks, you're like, you can hear where they're like dipping out what the MC is like going over stuff. But there was a value, cash value to the artist then, right? So if a track was released or got out before the release date, there was serious financial consequences for the label because they were pressing X amount of stuff. And it's just different, right? Because you could go through 10,000 copies of a record then, right? And it would fly off the shelves if it was the shit. Now, good luck selling 50 copies of something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny because a lot of people, it seems like every 6 months there'll be this like, fuck Spotify round of stories going around on whatever social media apps that you're using. And like, I'm thinking, well, especially in regards to dance music or techno or house or whatever, Spotify isn't really exactly the problem. You know what I mean? Like there's still a lot of piracy, which people, when's the last time you ever heard anybody talk about piracy? But let's say people download this new EP 400 times and those are 400 people that would have bought it. I mean, that's a huge amount of money right there that the label wasn't going to get. Yet they're bitching about Spotify not being able to pay out more, which I think they should, but that's not the...
But do people listen to single... I guess I don't...
That's what I'm getting, like...
I guess I consume most dance music through DJ sets, like, on its own, maybe it's part of being a DJ and just being ADD, but, like, I click past it after, like, 2 minutes, hard for me to listen... Especially if you have this like intro and outro DJ tool version of it. It's like, it's hard to listen to multiple times.
I get it. I mean, like my Spotify is 95%. I call it real music, but not club music. You know what I mean? Not that I have anything against it, but then I would rather just, if I'm lazy, if I want to hear something, I'll go on YouTube and clip through it for 30 seconds and then I'm good on it for a few years or something. But or, you know, hop on the decks if you have them at home and play around that way a bit.
Yeah, I think I go back to like vintage mixes a lot. I think that's my favorite way to consume it.
Same.
Because it's like, it's how it was played, or like maybe the nostalgia I have when I heard that mix or picked up that mix, or maybe I was at that show. Those tracks have a bit more of that association for me than the song as a, like a standalone. I'm sure there are some tracks that like, yeah, when I'm driving or something, I'm going to pull up on Spotify to like speed really quick to or something. But yeah, it's, you know, I think the economics of music and the viability of releasing songs, it's just insane now, right? So when you're, I'm sure you'll have people who'll be like, hey, send me a track or something because I'm doing a mix. Like, you really can't go on Beatport and spend a dollar, right?
Yeah.
Like, I appreciate you thinking about including me on this mix, but it's super weird that I've got to send you the file, right? Yeah, like,
totally. I mean, I guess like if it's unreleased in your homies or something, that might be one thing. But the other is like, if the record's been out for a week or two already, and then like, yo, can you send me this? It's like, I totally can, but I'm slow.
It's $2.
It's $2. So either just go grab it, or you can steal it off of Soulseek in the next 30 seconds. If you're waiting on me, you'll get it in 3 days. You know, like, figure it out.
Yeah, it does. There seems to be this, you know, also with promo culture, it's like there's almost this hesitation to buy music. And I think unless you put that money back in and are a consumer as well, you can't expect other people to do the same thing, right? So like buying music to me is still, it's hard for me to listen to promos and get it, right? I think I've got to be looking for it, for the track to mean anything. And most of the time it's like, I'm hearing it in a Dustin's On set or something. And then I'm like, I got to find that track, right? And then, mm-hmm. and then I go, and I'm like, I'm going to copy this mix too, even.
Just pop it in the CDJ.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, there's totally something to it, you know, like as the fucking music industry crumbles and there's less money to go around, you know, producers, they want to get by. Well, who else is going to buy the music? Other producers, basically, or they should. Like, I don't mind spending money on music. I'll go drop $30 on Bandcamp and probably play two of those songs. But I don't really feel like it's a waste because I'm like, listen, I really like it when money comes into my PayPal account. So I'm sure these bastards will like it too, you know?
And it's funny because you also see DJs that get angry when they post this mix on Facebook, and the bot that's there to protect the IP, right, and to get mechanical clicks, takes it down, and they're like, "Well, this is totally destroying art," and you kind of can't have it both ways, right? It's either that there's a system in place that mechanically will recognize and get you a payout because they're fighting this distribution, or everyone can just play whatever and the internet can't be stopped, right? So of course the internet can't be stopped, but it's funny to complain about it on both sides, right? You're like, the mix should be out there and nothing should be able to stop it because this is my art. But at the same time, you know, the mechanical clicks, which are very little, right? Like, you're getting nothing off these mechanicals. So, but it's something. It's like kind of representative, at least.
Exactly. So what's the current vibe in Chicago? How's it feeling out there right now?
Violent.
Violent?
You know, Chicago, at least politically, you know, we hit some rough times and we're in a transitional state. So, I live Southwest Side, which is maybe, it's strange because the nice areas of Chicago, that's where the huge risings, that's not our word, increase of crimes and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you ever want to know about Chicago, just ask, like, some old mega boomer. He'll tell you all about it, whether it's right or not, but he's got opinions, it seems. Chicago, Chicago, Chicago.
Chicago's always gone through it.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
And it's a rough city. I think, for me, the biggest change, at least not musically, is there's kind of this... and I think the world is shifting this way. I'm just kind of in my own zone that there's almost this fear of immigration and crimes associated with it. And I'm like, Chicago is one of those places that everybody knows somebody who's undocumented, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's rare that you're not friends with somebody like that. So to start to say or think that, you know, maybe there's facts and numbers that back these things up, but to know somebody then that's like, man, there's this rise in crime with immigration. You're like, it's a crazy thing to say in a city like Chicago, right? So I get it. You know, there might be some truth behind it. It just seems weird, right?
Yeah.
Musically, Chicago got hit quite hard. So there's just all these laws about everything, right? So to get a liquor license, to get various things, there's all these hurdles. Post lockdown, or almost every venue had to take some kind of government loan or loan that many of them are still paying back. And due to that, a lot of the promoters and clubs actually got together and became as Live Nation and kind of these bigger companies moved in, the only way to stay afloat was to become that big bad, right? And at first, it seemed like a really good idea, right? Everyone get together, everyone's like-minded. This is how we stay afloat and stay valid. But that's exactly how big corporation forms, right? So no. It's just a matter of time until some of these conglomerates are somewhat doing the same things and practices are similar. So musically, it's, from my perspective, seems like we're constantly still in payback mode, right? We're still trying to pay back from COVID and like everyone is still at this loss. And so that's also like, strangely, sometimes the excuse for lineups, and sometimes you justify like, well, we have to have this to be able to pay the rent. And I get that, right? Mm-hmm. You have to get people to do that. But sometimes that's not even working. There is no surefire nights in Chicago. Like the most, you know, sometimes my opinion is brought in for some friends' events. And I'm like, this is totally going to sell out. And then there's 10 people there, right? And then I'm totally on the hook, like, and I feel guilty that I recommended this person and it was a friend and they had a bad experience. And I'm like, well, listen, never mind. I have no idea. I'm not recommending anything anymore because I feel bad about it. But I think it's always been like that though, right? Like there's been none of the clubs really associate with each other, right? So the smart bars, the spy bars, sound bars, they all have their own thing. Everyone kind of works with their friends and the people they're familiar with, which is totally fine. Like if you're the talent buyer, book whoever you want, right? However, you can't make claims then about you are representing this, that, and that. You're representing a segment. And that's okay, right? Like you only know what you know, right? When I, if somebody asks me for recommendation of a DJ, it's not somebody I'm looking up randomly on the internet, right? It is somebody that I generally think can do the job. Most of the time, I might be friends with that person, right? Maybe I wouldn't be, but you know, the industry is quite small, so you form relationships quickly. And so it's nepotism, but it's like, I don't want to say it's good nepotism. It's like a nepotism in a way that you don't want to make bad recommendations either, right? You want to make professional recommendations. But sometimes you make recommendations based on something you saw on the internet. You're like, yo, you should book this person. I saw this crazy clip and people seem to love it. Like, I think you're going to make money if you book this. But sometimes that's totally wrong because Chicago has nothing to do with Europe and even New York or LA. The trends are just not similar.
It's all every bigger city just seems to have a wildly different take on things, which is cool in a way. You know, like I said earlier about producers and stuff, they don't have their own sounds, but the vibes, at least in America and the countries, are different. Same with Europe, really. I guess that's a global thing in general, but Chicago to me is it's not like I've been there much in the last 10 years or whatever, but I always felt like even since the late 90s, it was this kind of everybody is kind of out for themselves sort of thing. Or absolutely. Not necessarily that. Well, it is that, but like more on the like, well, this is what we're doing, and if you don't want to be part of it, then whatever. You know what I mean? Like
there is a lot of physical segregation. There's a lot of kind of scene segregation. Like even the gay scene there, there's like chop between there. If you're west side, south side, north side, you went to different places, right? And but I think that's what made the music great. Like we weren't booking each other. We only kind of messed with the people. I think Midwesterners are also shy kind of to begin with, so you kind of just fuck with your friends, right? And then that could be a bad thing, that could be a good thing, but you also, at least musically, I think, develop a sound because of that, right? When no one else is booking you and you have to throw your own parties and then it's you and your two friends doing stuff, I think it's going to have its own flavor, right? And then if that takes off and then people are like, well, now we want in on this, right? You're going to be like, no, fuck off, dude. You totally were rude to me 5 years ago and I hold a grudge. So why am I going to work with you now that things are going well? And that's a super Chicago way to do stuff. I've tried to not be so kind of stuck in the past about like perceived disses from people, because maybe my perception of it was wrong and I'm also like overreactive about stuff. So you also find out that stories weren't true, right? Like,
no.
You're like, this person, you thought this person maybe gatekeeped something or whatever. And it ended up just being me being jealous, right? Or me just like wanting something so bad that there's like insane story just kind of went in my head and I believed it, right? And then years later, you'll form a relationship with this person. You'll be like, what the heck was I thinking, right? Like, I've totally villainized the situation just based on my own insecurities. So I think in Chicago, we're bad at talking to each other about that, right? Yeah. And like maybe even confronting those situations.
I mean, insecurity is a big issue, I think, for anybody of any age, but especially at the age that we're all going out and partying and having fun. And it's pretty easy to read people the wrong way. I'm sure most people listening have been on that side of one of those sides of the fence or both. You know, like I had multiple times over the years where like internet feedback or whatever, where I was wished dead.
Wait, what? You know,
yeah. And, but actually,
I need to see this.
One person came up years later and they're like, hey, yo, I need you to know that like on this forum, I said that I wished you were dead and blah, blah, blah. And well, you know what? It turns out you're pretty cool. I take it back. I'm sorry. And I'm like, okay, we're cool. You know,
have you seen them again?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I've said the worst stuff to people on the internet. And that I don't really regret, right? Like, especially on like Midwest Raves and Pureboard and... that was just the way you spoke to each other back then, yeah. Right?
I mean, you know, the 80s and 90s, it was much harsher times. You know, now everybody's more considerate of everybody's thoughts and feelings. And back then, it's just like...
Well, I think it was also like, we had like anime icons with some made up name and it wasn't our real picture. So it was like, it wasn't real.
It didn't
right?
feel real, yeah.
And so it was like... You're going into a video game, so you are trying to say the most, whatever's going to get you the most attention on this system or is going to create a reaction.
And you were hoping for at times a negative one too. You
absolutely.
Know, like my avatar on the old MN Vibe board was a crucifixion dildo. You know, like. I was trying to...
But that was the internet then.
That was, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it was about confrontation, pornography, gambling, and finding MP3 rips, right?
Wait, that's still what the internet is.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's, you know, there's always this, there's this difference now that I think people form relationships on the internet without, you know, this is generational and I think speaks to how old I am and how long I've been dealing with it. I don't know you if I just know you on the internet, right? As much as we might talk to each other, have something, you're a stranger, right? Mm-hmm. Because I know how much I can fabricate something on the internet, right? Once you place something on social media, there's a fair amount of thought, right? Because you're not texting to your friend. You're not texting to some trusted entity. You're putting out intentionally to the world, right? For consumption. So I don't know you until I know you. So
yeah.
Physically meeting somebody, And I think that's different now. I think kids, I hate saying kids, but kids,
yeah,
they'll form relationships and date each other online, right?
Yeah. I mean, especially like in the gaming world, there's a lot of people that just don't fit in school or whatever. And then they find this camaraderie online, or maybe not even gaming, but let's just say, for the lack of better wording, like more nerdy stuff that's not like fucking basketball or whatever, yeah, you know?
I mean, for me, that was a big, I used to play a lot of online games and met really cool people, but there was this point that we would physically meet up, right?
Yeah.
And you'd be like, well, this person's actually a creep, right? And we don't talk to him anymore. But I actually made lifelong friends off video games before. But there's this line for me personally that's not crossed until we are sitting across the table from each other, right? And you know, it's just different because you can write anything on when you're typing, right? So,
mm-hmm. And so, I mean, yeah, I've had it a lot too, where, you know, with this podcast, people come up and I'm pretty much willing to give anybody 5-10 minutes of the time, at least, to whatever, you know, if they want to chat, I'll chat. But then sometimes they're like, they think that they know you. And I'm like, well, I'm not bullshitting you when I'm on the microphone, but I'm like, I promise you don't, because there's a lot that I'm just never going to talk about on the mic from my personal life.
And yeah, you know? How can you, right? Like, yeah, you're not writing a book. You're talking about a specific subject and ideally you're presenting yourself in the best way possible too, right? You're like, I don't want to sound like somebody you don't want to know, right? Yeah. And you know, especially if you're an artist, right?
I can't let them know I'm racist. You know what I mean?
Oh, everybody knows that. So.
But you kind of had a podcast type show running for a while, the Misery Index, right? Or
yes, yeah, we did a little Twitch stream during lockdown. It was kind of on the heels of DJs and Beers disbanding. Drumcell, Luis Flores, we were always just kind of texting each other, really gross videos or, at the time it actually started, there was this video of Anfisa Letiago,
mm-hmm,
and she's just like DJing on this like really serene thing. And it's to me, I was like, wow, this is amazing. And I think we all had kind of a difference of opinion about what these things meant. And that was a jumping point to kind of argue about stuff, right? And I was like, oh, this is a great subject to argue about. Because as long as I've known them, we've always had very different takes on stuff, right? And that's why I do appreciate about the friends that I do have, is we can have very different takes on music and play way different music. It has nothing to do with our friendship, right?
Like, yeah,
I could totally think you played the corniest set and tell you that. But if you think it's good, then I will completely back you, right?
Yeah.
But if I see you caving as a person, then we have a problem as a friendship, right? So it was a thing that Seth Truxler had actually set up. And we spoke about this a bit off mic, but he had this idea that it would be like a public access cable TV show. So it would never rebroadcast. You'd have to tune in. We were arguing that people did not know what public access cable was. And so that got lost in the communication. And we're also just not great at kind of talking to the chat either, right? And you know, I know people that are killing it on Twitch, right? And making money and doing well. That's not something I think any of us were kind of comfortable about approaching, like asking for donations at the time or it was just kind of new to us, right?
Yeah.
And we also just were complaining, which is why it was called Misery Index. Like, no real like politics just were talked about.
Online commisery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When we were, you know, I think the three of us handled lockdown as bad as any person could handle it, right? Like, some people, like, they bake bread.
I loved
kids.
It.
I had the worst time. And then it was part of kind of dealing with it, was being able to just talk to each other as well.
See, I had all the worst time prior to that, from like 2018 to 2020, just fucking taking an L everywhere you look, whether it's taxes, family death, blah, blah, blah. And so then when I got to chill during the pandemic and, like you said, bake bread or whatever, I'm like, this is fucking great. I don't have to pay any bills, which I don't have any money anyway. And all I can do is hang out and actually catch up on shit like movies or video games that I was never going to have a chance for. So it was like the first time I could catch my breath. But as you said, yeah, there were a lot of friends who were not taking it well, and it was a really bad time. So I try not to rub it in that it was good for me. But
no, I think it's also how you are as a person, right? It was like, here was this unimaginable circumstance that none of us really could fathom, right? So there was no planning, there was no mental preparation when you're just like, what? This is a sci-fi movie? Like, this is, I don't understand anything. So it also taught you a lot about what your reflex was for those kinds of things. And it was also a good time to see which friends kept in touch with each other and were checking in on each other. And for me personally, it was career-wise or music career-wise, it was a wake-up call. Like, I'd always really approached DJing and music as a fun thing that was always there, right? And there was kind of a lack of sincerity, I'd say, right? I was having a bit of success before lockdown. And then so when that all went away, for me, I thought this is probably never coming back to like, the restaurant.
I thought so too.
So I was like, wow, what am I going to do now, right? If things don't come back, I can't serve coffee well. Like, I have no idea how to make those patterns in a fucking latte, right? Like, those people are awesome at doing that, right?
I don't think some of them are.
So I don't think I could ever do that. Like, so yeah, it was a tough time. And yeah, the show was great. Sorry, I'm rambling, but
that's all good.
The show was a way to deal with that and bring friends on to talk about stuff, talk about releases, because I know for some people, releases actually got a lot of traction during lockdown. Everything I put out just went to like five people bought it, right? So it was also, infuriating somewhat to release music and then just being like, well, no one is buying this, right?
Yeah.
And then you're like, am I making DJ tools? Like, what is the difference between these tracks that are doing super well, even though there's no dance floors right now? Is it because they're deeper content or, yeah.
It was a weird time. Sometimes things fall to the side. I put out one EP and I knew that it was probably going to take a dive just because of the times. And of course it did. And I'm like, fuck, I thought that was one of my better ones, but whatever.
How much did you work on music during that time?
I made just under 80 tracks in 2020.
80 tracks? Yeah. Oh my God.
I had nothing else to do. And I didn't really know if club techno was coming back. But, you know, since we were in lockdown, I couldn't really get my musician friends to send me over stuff to work on, like new band projects or anything, because, you know, usually you get together in the studio and you kind of, works better when you can tell someone like, do this or do that, rather than having to send files back and forth. So I just made that, you know, and eventually the world opened back up. And by that point, I was like, it was the first time in my life that I wasn't on the road every weekend. I'm like, actually, normal life is kind of enjoyable. So I've slowed down a little bit, partly by my choice and partly not, but I'm not really complaining anymore, you know. Have you ever thought about starting a new podcast?
I'm pretty inconsistent about getting things done. So I was in journalism for a long time. So I used to write like video game reviews and anime reviews. So I used to do a lot of just writing about stuff and music reviews. And that quickly became a job, right? Mm-hmm. And so started padding words to get paid more. And then when you were at the bigger kind of video game review companies, when you're smaller on the totem pole, you get the worst games to review, right? So it's always like the trashware, right? And so it also became to this point that I was not even really playing the games. I'd like boot them up and get this general idea and then read other people's reviews and kind of write around that. And then once I recognized I was doing that, I was like, I can't do this anymore. I'm out. And then people stopped reading blogs that like went away as well. So it stopped becoming a paying job. And then it's like, all structure of me doing things timely went away after that. And I just became so bad at it. And I think partially there needs to be, for me at least, a discussion, right? I have to be actually either on a Zoom call or sitting with somebody. And I also don't trust my mouth, right? Like if you've hung out with me and we've had a couple drinks, there's like 5 minutes that I'm speaking rehearsed and politically correct, but that falls apart pretty quickly. So I've got 5 minutes of like nice conversation in me.
Yeah, I was thinking like, fuck, is it going to go off the rails? But
yeah, since
we're both a little exhausted from the weekend, it's been very mellow, and probably that's what'll save our careers.
I'll yell something out that'll get us in trouble, don't worry.
All right. Well, I mean, it's unavoidable. Let's talk about the memes.
Yes, the memes.
I'm really brain dead today, and in the notes, all I put is how.
Yeah, so, gosh, the memes. It started, I think, I've always just been posting stuff on whatever platform was out there. Then, you know, for me, Instagram was about like looking at models and stuff, right? So my relationship was never about like, I always tell people, especially people that get frustrated looking at, like they judge their artist career based on Instagram. I'm like, dude, this is a pictures page.
Totally.
Right? So I know what I'm looking at on here, and it's not DJs, right? So you have to curate your own feed. So on mute, like maybe if you have to be friends with some DJ politically, mute them. If you don't want to look at, if they don't look awesome and they're not on a treadmill and like working out every day and they're not great to look at, then mute them, because this is about pictures.
I concur.
Right? So, at the time, some industry friends of mine were just also reposting stuff a lot. So I used to work with Shade 45 a bit, which is Eminem's label. So my friend Jude on there had a million followers. Some friends from hip hop, adult actress friends reposting stuff. And then I think things really blew up. Gosh, I hate this because I just said this in another interview, but,
I'm curious.
I was talking, to the actress Awkwafina. She was just a YouTuber at the time and doing, rap albums and stuff. So her and I were talking about sending some beats back and forth, and I was a big fan of her skits and her raps. And then
I liked her show.
It's everything super funny. Yeah. And she was a much more raw act back then. And then she was on Crazy Rich Asians and blew up. And then so that whole crew started reposting all my stuff. And then the page just kind of gained a lot of traction. which was also a bad thing because it also kept getting reported, right?
Yeah. Like,
the peak was Gwyneth Paltrow had reposted one of my things. And I think one image got like...
Was it the vagina candle stuff or what?
No, she had reposted something or like some like anime boobs or something. But the post got reported like 1,000 times. So then I hit the shadow ban suddenly and I didn't know what that was.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that got out of control quickly. But it generally is something that whether or not there was an audience there, I'd still be doing it, right? So even when I was doing game reviews and writing about UFC fights, kind of injecting my sense of humor was a big part of that. And then fitting into that platform. So for me, first off, I promoting yourself on Instagram is hard, right? Yeah. To be like, hey, I've got a new record out. You can say that like once, right? And then, you know, saying come to my show, you have as many posts as you are obligated to, right? Mm-hmm. Before it becomes really weird that you're like, please come to my show, right? And then I'm on there like liking cat girls already, right? So it's like I'm already on this app constantly. So it's almost this compulsion to post stuff. So
yeah. I get it. I mean, like some of it's pretty raw or extremely raw, you know, but like are there, you know, because some of it cuts deep. So when it comes to things like sexuality, depression, anxiety, relationships, stuff like that, do you get people responding? They're like, yeah, preach. Or do you get people like fucking super angry with you because it touches a nerve?
Yeah, there's both sides of that. So, you know, there's been a few times I kind of make it a rule not to open up my DMs, right? Because there's just been a few times that people have been either in situations of self-harm or kind of talking about things that I have no right to speak on, right? Mm-hmm. Especially if it triggers something. And so the only thing I could do was, you know, give them the worst typical advice, like call a professional and don't talk to this random stranger on the internet, dude. Like, you know,
no.
Maybe we like the same anime and we've had the same heartbreak, but I'm posting on the internet, like I'm probably the worst person to give advice, especially if I'm relating to you right now, right? As well as you'll have people on the extreme side also be like, I think it's important that you make this political statement with your platform because you have X amount of followers.
Yeah.
Or it's dangerous to say these things, right? Or you are putting this negative message or whatever spin out there. That might be, right? And especially if I have ever seen harm come of stuff, then like some people, there are jokes maybe I totally don't get, mm-hmm. that there's maybe some embedded racism or sexism or some kind of joke there that I totally don't pick up on. As soon as somebody tells me like, this actually means this, I'm like, yo,
oh, yeah.
I better take this off quickly, right? But there's no getting around that. People, especially like, your memes are passive aggressive and kind of vague on purpose, mm-hmm. right? So people will take it separate ways, but there's all this other stuff in there that historically, I don't necessarily know what that image comes from. I just saw it or somebody sent it to me and I was like, laughed about it or kind of thought it was cool or, and that is a constantly changing line for me, right? So
yeah.
One day to the other, my sensibility is going to be different.
Totally. I mean, comedy is a topical thing, and I think that's what a lot of people don't realize because they became so conditioned to whatever wholesome comedy bullshit shows on TV, and they think that it's all supposed to be good. But realistically, a lot of comedy is supposed to be a little punchy.
Yeah, it's supposed to ride the line, yes.
like society changes and so should comedy. Like, I know if people listen to the first episodes of this podcast, there's probably shit on there that I would never say right now, you know?
I mean, always the jokes I'm going to make in private are going to be different than the jokes I make in public. But even some stand-up shows, I'll go back and watch some Netflix specials, and I don't find them funny anymore, right?
Yeah,
and
totally.
Ethically, though, as far as comedy is concerned, that started to bother me. I was like, why am I bothered by this now, right? Is it social conditioning? Has my own morality on this changed? Because the protected idea of a joke, right, and how the joke pursues it. But in the end, you got to trust your gut. And you're like, this is just not funny. I'm not, as a consumer, I'm not going to give this money anymore. It doesn't necessarily mean that I've canceled a comic. It's just I didn't like that one thing. Maybe the next time, as an entertainer, they're going to come out with something that is more in that I find funny, right? But it's also what's going on at the time in my life and politically, or what's on the news, that's going to change what I'm even sensitive to, right? Like, my own tolerance for things is going to be different based on whatever is going on that day.
Absolutely. You know, and it's things like, even take a specific comedian or something, they can maybe fall off on some weird ass tangent for a while because that's what they're going through in their life and they find to be funny, and then they come back a few years later and then they're back on their game and they realize, like, I was just in a dark spot. I was putting out bullshit, you know? And I think that also the thing these days is, now when we're a more interconnected world and people are being more open about everything, it really
is. Which I think is good.
Oh, yeah.
Like, but know your enemy and know your friend. Right?
Totally. But, you know, so it's almost inevitable that if you're trying to crack a joke, you could probably find somebody that you would offend. I think the goal is just to not purposely try to do it, but also, like, watch the barometer and be like, all right, maybe these aren't the jokes for now, or this shit's tired. You know what I mean? Like,
It's conditional, but I think also at the same time, there is a standard that you have to be realistic about, right? So I have racist family members. I have friends that have completely different political views, or they may have disagreements with gender politics and stuff like that. Having a disagreement over stuff like that, for me personally, sometimes isn't a friend ending thing, right? It is something that if I feel strongly about it, I will tell the person, hey, I don't like it when you say this. So don't say this when we're around, like, say this with your other friends. But it's a fine line, because sometimes you'll find yourself defending a piece of shit, right? Out of, like, nostalgia. You're like, I'm actually, this person is doing all this bad stuff, but I'm thinking about how things were when we were 16, right? And what that meant, but that's not that person anymore. So it's such on a case-by-case basis that, like, almost generalizing comedians too, like, there's this whole, like, kind of movement now that comedians are getting canceled, right? Because of what they're saying. I personally don't think that's a case. I think there is no cancellation, really.
No. Like,
what does that mean, right?
I mean, cancellation, the whole idea behind it is bullshit. Like, especially in the music industry, all these DJs that are supposedly canceled, they have a schedule in their year that's busier than you and I combined. They're making tons of money still. Like, so their bookings drop off for 2 months, but then they're back at it. You know, people that did really fucked up shit, too.
Yes.
You know, I mean, like, there are some that are definitely just off the map forever, and we won't even bring their names up. But for the most part, anybody that, like, got into trouble on Resident Advisor or something, they're still out there crushing it, making a lot of money, getting bookings from all the biggest promoters. Like, cancellation, it's bullshit. I don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't stick. And, you know, there's this idea of, like, having to have the X amount of people rally behind an idea for it to matter. And I think that's that kind of mob mentality, if you believe something is strong enough, you kind of have to be actionable about it yourself, right? Like, if you, and maybe this is an old Chicago mentality, if something upsets you so much that like, you're not going to go over to someone's house and whip their ass over it, then leave it alone, right? Like there's a point that you have to take matters into your own hands and do something about it. And if someone has done something egregious to a friend or a loved one, and your response is to make a post about it, that's kind of weird to me, right? But that's my own ethics, right? So,
yeah, I mean, that's also the generational thing too, that people feel like by making that post, they're doing their part or whatever, or balancing the scales. And who am I to judge whether that's right or not? But I just ultimately, it seems like any guy I've ever seen get canceled somehow seems to be doing just as well as ever 6 months down the road, you know?
Yeah, and it's like the people that I've attacked personally online, I just don't like them. And I've been looking for them to do something stupid and give me ammo to like say something to them, right? So they're just like an unlikable person. And I've been saying stuff to them. And now here's something that like other people are saying too. So I'm like, heck yeah, dude. You know, you're a dick, dude. You know, and now other people see your dick. Like, now I will fight you.
Showing your true colors and all that.
Yes.
I know that you got a heart out here in about 15 minutes, so I realized we didn't even really get to talk much about the studio side of things. So you want to talk about that real quickly?
Sure. Right. Studio has been slow going. You know, had a couple releases. I've probably got 100 one-minute loops. You know, I work a lot with Orlando Submerge on stuff.
Good dude.
He's great dude, very busy. Is just a workhorse about getting stuff done. But I think even our tastes have separated so much that collaborating on stuff is difficult. I was just telling somebody about this last EP I did with Justin Cudmore. It's something we did over lockdown. Every iteration we would send to each other, we were really hated each time. We're like, you just undid the entire idea of the track, right?
Yeah.
Which was kind of the fun of it, right? And figuring out process there. So it's a struggle. And for me, touring zaps out away quickly some of that inspiration. So it's mostly been remixes that have a deadline and some idea behind it. Lots of times in the studio, I mean, kind of recording other people or engineering stuff. If there's just not a great idea, I kind of just don't have a reason, right? The impulse to have tracks out is not there anymore that it used to be. I feel like the songs have to be of a certain caliber. And part of this may be reactionary from tracks not doing well over lockdown. So I was chair squeaking. And then I think I had like two remixes that weren't picked up. And then there was an EP that I'd worked on that just didn't get picked up. And I think there's some like trauma behind it that I'm still going through where I'm like, God, I can't believe that this didn't do what we thought it was going to do. Right.
That sucks when that happens.
Yes. And it's crazy when it's friends too, because then that mixes business. And then, like I had a friend reject a remix that I thought, oh, this is perfect. And they're going to love it. And then in the end, they're like, well, this doesn't work. And it's important that you be able to have that conversation, right? And I can be mad at them and be like, you jerk. I still think this is a proper track. But this is their release. They have to curate it. They have to know, right? So, and then I kind of went into this mode of just getting too much stuff, right? Just getting buried under the idea of each next piece of gear was going to solve the problem, and it just made things worse. But it's still really fun, right? Like each new piece of gear is entertainment. And I'm lucky that we have friends in the studio, so we get to jam together, and that's a big part of having fun.
Absolutely. So who's the worst collaborator you've ever worked with? You don't have to answer
that. The worst
that.
Collaborator, I can answer that. I've worked with a lot of folks that they either just kind of, they're just in the room, right? Yeah. And then feel like they've had
input,
some input, and maybe they said something, but it was totally wrong, right? And then to have this conversation of that this was a collaboration. You know, of course, for me, there are lots of tracks that, like, I did one thing on, right? Or maybe I played in the notes on a totally different instrument and they're redone. So there's a sliding scale. So, you know, I'm not totally innocent of doing 20% of a track and having my name on it as well. But there's, especially in the studio that I'm in, and maybe kind of socially, there is a bit of, in Chicago, this idea that you have to have a track out, right? To do this next thing in your career. And then I'm sure you've also dealt with this. There is a idea that collaborating with you is going to help the release, right? So if we do this track together, your name is hot right now, so this is going to help sell the track. And that's just not true, right?
Yeah, like, it has to be good also.
Good people aren't dumb, right? Yeah. Like song has to be good. And like I've collaborated with some amazing artists and the track sounds like two tracks. And it's just not a good song. So even though at the end they might think it's there, I don't personally think it's there, right? You can hear the fighting of this thing where it goes from like BPM Tulum vibes to some techno track. And like, this just doesn't make sense. Are you kidding?
There's
me?
No dance floor for this vibe.
Yes. It's just, if it's like a joke, then okay. But this sounds like two records mixed together. And so you kind of have to also know when to call it quits and be like, we can be friends and collaborators, but we have totally different ideas about where music is going. And that can be heartbreaking at times, right?
Yeah.
Especially if you've worked together with folks and your tastes or ideas grew apart, then to not work together in the future, it can be hurtful for people, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been on both sides of that coin in the collaborative process where you think you did really great work on this track, or you gave them something that they can really run with. And then you get it back 2 weeks later and it's either completely different or you're chopped out almost entirely. And you're like, well, this fucking sucks. I thought the old one was better. But then it's also important to remember, like, well, who's kind of running points on this show? And like, if you are existing, like, let's say as an engineer to help somebody get something across the finish line, then I think it's important just to help them to follow their dreams, essentially. But if it's like, we're going to do this together and it's going to be our fun thing and take, you know, share the credit or whatever.
You got to be very clear about that ahead of time.
Exactly. Yeah. Otherwise, it's just, you're going to waste a lot of time and shit's going to sit on hard drives.
And I was talking to Kyle about this. There was a couple times that I really can't mix stuff myself. It just, I'm not the person to get a good mix together. Just everything is colliding. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple releases in a row that two separate people had actually made modifications to the track without mentioning it to me. They sent me the track back and I was like, I think something shifted in the lineup. I don't know if maybe I put it out wrong. And they're like, well, no, it was actually kind of boring there. And I was like, well, yeah, that's crazy to say. You might be right. You're probably right that it was boring there. But it's kind of weird to send it back to me without mentioning it. Like, you can easily say, this sucks right here. You should add something to make it exciting or whatever. And then there is also this kind of idea that there's folks that are just like, well, we've got this track together. You should just put your name on this. It's going to be great. That's kind of weird, right? Yeah. Like, maybe if there was like a lot of money behind it, and I was like, okay, if you've got a bunch of cash and this is financially going to help me pay for something, maybe I'll do that. But no one's paying me that kind of cash right now. So that's always a weird thing, but it happens a lot now. So.
Yeah. I've had that a couple times where, like you said, you put in 2 cents, but they really want to use the name anyway. And they're like, let's do it. And it feels awkward and it comes out. And I'm like, well, this isn't really me. And then like you're saying, if it was a lot of money, maybe it's different, but I didn't get shit. I still haven't seen a dime from either of those that I'm thinking of. So I don't really do it this way unless I'm really heavily involved now, you know?
It's just, it's out there, right? So yeah. you are held to the judgment of the world. So at least if I made a bad track, I can take the licks for that, right? Versus, mm-hmm. some track that, you know, maybe I was like, yo, you should open up the filter here or something. Like, that's, I don't know, that's not really fun, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, sometimes notes are handy and even good, but, you know, the whole process is just how it's approached is a different thing. But it's like you said, you have to make sure that it's represents you, basically. You know what I mean? Like, for example, for myself, I'm not going to win any Instagram Model of the Year awards.
Look pretty good.
I already determined that, like, the legendary DJ title just isn't in the cards for me. I accept that. The only thing that I can, like, fall back on is production. So I got to make sure going forward with my discography that it's, like, not a shit show. You know what I mean?
I don't know. You're kind of a legend, I would
say.
Well,
thank you.
You are a legend.
I think...
Hey! Yo,
that's fucking loud.
You didn't tell me that was there.
Yeah, I got all these buttons.
Oh my god, I'm gonna do some Fred again.
we can even change voices and stuff. It's fun.
Oh my god, this could have went a totally different way if I knew that was there.
Well, you know, we can just do it again with the actual drinks and try to get canceled. But
yeah, you know, it's just I hate this. Yeah, I don't even consider myself a good producer. It's like just this thing I like to do. I like to play music and I might as well capture it. And there's so many tracks I have that are actually embarrassing that I have out there where I'm like, I can't believe this went out. But it was representative of a time. So I like to look back at that and be like, oh, I understand now, like, 32 bars is where you should put this thing in, and you shouldn't, you know, just throw everything out stereo and record it and then just throw everything through Lander and send it off and it's good to go. You know, that's part of the, I guess, markings of your life once you're maybe not here around or you're kind of just leaving data out there. If it sucks, I would like to be the one that made it suck versus, you know, some random person.
I've had that where all of a sudden it comes out. I didn't even know there was a promo or a master available, and the mastering engineer just destroys the shit out of it. I'm like, this doesn't even sound the same anymore.
I actually was able to get a track recalled by saying that I was just going to have a hissy fit on the internet if they actually released it because there was no contract out there. They had like this MP3 demo that I had sent them, and then it pops up on Beatport. I was like, this track is bad.
I've had that too, and they renamed the fucking thing and all that, and I was just like, what the hell?
Yeah. Is production that in line with DJing? For me, they're completely separate skill sets and ideas, right? Of course, as a DJ, you want to make that perfect track, right? You're chasing that, so that helps. However, skill set wise, I find very little adjacency to what I would do in a DJ situation to, like, I rarely play my own tracks. I play a lot of Zahn tracks. But,
there you go.
It's just, I've heard the track 1,000 times by the time it's out. So yeah. Unless it's like some remix with somebody else, it's so awkward for me to play it, right?
Absolutely. Well, I know you got to get out of here in a minute. She's got a tight schedule in Berlin, and I was like, you got to come over Tuesday. You got
to
come over.
I know. I'm so excited to be here. I appreciate it.
Is there anything that people should look out for this spring or summer that, you know, dates to plug or podcasts or records or anything?
Yo, you should come see me play. Help me. hang out with me.
Help me.
Send the goth girls. Watch cool anime. Yeah.
That sounds pretty good to me.
There's 2 Godzilla films out this year, dude. We are winning.
I know. They fucking just keep cracking those out. Is it one's with King Kong or something, right?
Godzilla and King Kong. As soon as I get back, that's the first thing I'm watching.
All right. Nice. All right. Well, have a good one. Thanks for swinging by.
Midwest represent. Thank you so much, legendary Dustin Zahn, for having me on.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.